Hi everyone, welcome to Octopod. My name is Allie and I am one of the hosts of this podcast along with the wonderful Ray and Nick. This podcast is produced by Octo, or Open Communications for the Ocean. Octo also produces newsletters, shares literature and news, runs listservs and more, all about the ocean, with the goal of connecting ocean professionals around the world and giving them the knowledge and networks they need to succeed. Each week, we will be sharing a little bit of the ocean news and scientific literature that has come to our attention in the past week, as well as any updates from Octo that can help you be more involved with ocean management and conservation. We are super excited to share what we have discovered each week with you ocean lovers. So without further ado, let's use a common ocean pun and dive right in. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Octopod. Excuse me, I can't even say our podcast name. Today, it's me, Allie, and Nick on, and we're going to talk about a literature item, and then sort of a news item. Nick's going to talk about something that is important with p-values that's been going around the interwebs. So I'm going to start off. The paper I'm going to talk about today is basically about seabird poop, which is wonderful. It's called Seabird Nutrients Are Assimilated by Corals and Enhance Coral Growth Rates. And it was published in mid-March, and the author's name is Candida Savage, which is an amazing name.
That is a great name.
I know, right? I wish I had a name like that. So basically, the addition of nutrients to an ecosystem can do lots of things. It can change up food webs, it can increase productivity, it can increase the stability of a community, among a bunch of other stuff. Nutrients can come into an ecosystem from other places as well, not just from that one ecosystem. So an example of this is like algae washing up on shore, or a whale or a bird pooping. It's pretty great when that happens, especially in places where there isn't a ton of production and growth, because it adds in stuff from other places, which makes sense. So what this study looked at was if that nutrient addition from other sources, in this case, seabird guano or poop, and anything else nutrient-like that seabirds emit. I don't know, maybe they're like feathers have something in them. I'm not really sure. We didn't talk about that a ton in the paper, but I was assuming, based on what they were talking about at the beginning of the paper, that it was all about seabird guano, all about poop. So anyway.
Do you want to say poop one more time?
I'm going to say poop a lot in this podcast. Anyways, if the adding of nutrients to an area from the seabirds influences coral growth rates. So that's what they wanted to find out. And I'm going to say that again. If adding nutrients from an area from seabirds influences coral growth rates. And so Candida did two experiments. One where she or they, her co-researchers, where they sampled corals from around an island with nesting seabirds called Namena Lili, which is also a wonderful word. This is in North Fiji. And one where they also grew and transplanted corals from Namena Lili to a physically similar and nearby island without seabirds. And then they compared the growth between the two islands. So they took lots of samples of zooxanthellae and nitrogen and stuff, and they found some really exciting results. So there was a super positive effect of the seabird nutrients, again, poop, there you go, Nick, on growth rates of a prevalent type of coral near the island. So the corals near the island grew a ton more. Actually, for the transplantation experiment, the corals near the seabird island had growth rates 4 times more than the corals grown near the no seabird island. For the sampling experiment, the farther from the island and the nesting seabirds, the less nitrogen was found in the zooxanthellae, which I didn't explain at all, but zooxanthellae is basically an algae that photosynthesizes and that lives in corals and has a great relationship with the corals, and that they take things excreted by the corals to use in their photosynthesis, and then they give the corals their photosynthesis byproducts, which are basically organic compounds that help the coral grow big and strong. Without zooxanthellae or without this algae, corals do not do well, and most of the time will die. So what does the nitrogen have to do with it? The nutrients from the seabirds increase the nitrogen in the water, because there's a lot of nitrogen in poop, which helps increase the zooxanthellae density, or the amount of the zooxanthellae, which enhances their photosynthesis, which in turn enhances the coral growth. So the more nitrogen, the more growth. In this case, too much nitrogen can be bad, and it could be bad, especially when it comes to what humans produce, but I'm not going to talk about that a ton because seabird nitrogen apparently is great for corals. So all in all, seabird poop can benefit coral reefs. Woohoo. And this should obviously be considered in management of islands and reefs and everything, especially since we have a ton of struggling seabird species out there and a ton of struggling coral species out there.
Wow.
So yeah. Yeah.
You know, speaking of guano, there is a fascinating exhibit at the Smithsonian in DC all about the early United States culture of, appropriating all these specific islands because of guano. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I've heard of that. There's a bunch of that was happening in California too, wasn't there? Like people go and they collect the guano. Back in the day, they used that as their primary fertilizer on crops.
Yeah, because that was, before we had figured out the Haber-Bosch method for nitrogen fixation.
Yes. Nuts. And then we did, and now we have too much nitrogen that we're putting off into the water. I guess I will talk about it. But yeah, super interesting paper, and oh, I didn't say where you could find it, but you can find that at oct.to/pod78, and that is a slash. Apparently I've been saying dash for the entirety of Octopod because I didn't know there was a difference.
Minor
but
days.
It's a slash. It's the diagonally looking one.
Every time I hear the word diagonally, I think about Diagon Alley and Harry Potter. Anyway, nerd time.
Well, yeah, we got a Harry Potter nerd over there.
And all I am sadly not going to talk about poop, which is depressing now that I think about it. But rather, there was a fascinating article going around the interwebs from Nature. And this article is called Scientists Rise Up Against Statistical Significance. And you can get to that quickly if you go to oct.to/pod79. So basically, let's just start off with the definition of a p-value. So it's the probability of getting a result more extreme than the one you got if your null hypothesis is true. But we need to, kind of unpack that a lot because we were paying attention. We were saying that, this is if your null hypothesis is true. But the whole thing is, when you're designing experiments, you are trying to see, if your alternative hypothesis is true. You're generally speaking banking from the start of the experiment that your null hypothesis is false. So that kind of means, what do p-values actually tell us? Yeah, pretty much nothing useful at all. And the statistics community has been, trying to get the word out on this to other scientists, and they've been working on this awareness campaign for decades now, and you can tell it hasn't really gotten that many people to change their opinions of p-values that much. But in the latest push of their awareness campaign, a bunch of statisticians, over 800 of them, signed an open letter urging scientists to stop incorrectly interpreting their results, aka to please stop lying about their stats. So this open letter focused on the idea that we can't say something is true or false, supported or not, real or just random chance, based on p-values, because p-values alone don't provide us with a dichotomous result. So we need to stop thinking about our scientific results in this dichotomous way, and we should rather be emphasizing uncertainty. So the Nature article mentions, and I quote, "Even if researchers could conduct two perfect replication studies of some genuine effect, each with 80% power or chance of achieving a p is less than 0.05, it would not be very surprising for one to obtain p is less than 0.01 and the other p is greater than 0.30. Whether a p-value is small or large, caution is warranted." And they continue, "Like the 0.05 threshold from which it came, the default 95% used to calculate or used to compute intervals is itself an arbitrary convention. It is based on the false idea that there is a 95% chance that the computed interval itself contains the true value, coupled with the vague feeling that this is a basis for a confident decision." Which, wow, this is one scathing letter and one scathing comment. And they continue, along the lines of what should we be using instead of p-values. And they say, "The objection we hear most against retiring statistical significance is that it is needed to make yes or no decisions. but for the choices often required in regulatory, policy, and business environments, decisions based on the cost, benefits, and likelihoods of all potential consequences always beat those based solely on statistical significance. Which I have to totally agree with him there. I mean, like, that makes total sense. You know, we should be looking at a whole lot more things. But it also seems just like, how on earth are you going to try to communicate scientific results to non-scientists in a way that really gets all this stuff across, you know? Because, I mean, I could just see people saying that, oh, well, you know, p-values don't mean anything and your confidence intervals don't mean anything, blah, blah, blah. So therefore, you know, your science was just completely useless. And, you know, that very well may be the case for a number of studies that, you know, don't really have anything else other than a p-value at their disposal to say that, you know, something is you know, useful or not. And it just seems like...
Well, like, the problem with science and science communication, a lot of it is that, like, a lot of papers don't give a yes or no answer. And so then people grab onto that and they're all like, well, you can't make up your mind. Like, we don't know, so we can't do anything about it. And then nothing ever gets done. So it's almost nice to have at least one way that we can be like, there's a yes or a no. And so we need to do something about it. At least in terms of management, we can't just like flip-flop a ton, you know? But at the same time, it's wrong. So we shouldn't, I don't know. It's a tough one. It would worry me if we moved away from p-values and that sort of dichotomous result that we are talking about in our science, because how would that affect what happens in the real world? How would that affect our management if we could never... I mean, if everyone's arguing like, oh, but they said this and it's not actually true, so maybe we shouldn't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's a rife way to just suggest that the science that we do is not robust enough. And it seems like a great way for, you know, certain political types out there to just, you know, easily say that, you know, we're throwing too much money into science and that, you know, it's just not actually doing anything good for society. But like, you know, especially with climate change communications and things like that, you know, uncertainty is very real. I mean, it's very much, you know, what we need to be talking about, because, you know, the estimates we have out there are, you know, climate change could be like completely catastrophic in just a few years based on some of the, you know, projections we have, but we really just don't know. And, you know, there are many people, myself included, who would say that, you know, we need to assume that those worst case scenarios can happen and prepare for those, because, like, you know, I mean, if you live in like a 100-year floodplain, like, you should definitely make sure you're not going to have your house flooded while you're living there. Like, may only happen once every 100 years, but there's a good chance it's going to happen while you're there still. So you need to do something. And, you know, it's how do you communicate science in a way to get across the uncertainty, but still get people to do things. That, I feel like, would be really hard.
Oh, that's a big thing.
Yeah, it's a lot to unpack. It's a lot to
It seems like a hard task. But hopefully everyone, like, we're up to it. I mean, obviously not in America.
Yes.
Maybe in other places. All right. Well, is that it, Nick?
Yes,
ma'am.
Anything
about Octo to talk about?
We'll be having a special episode of Octopod soon. I interviewed Dr. Mia Drews about her latest research, which we put in MarkHive. It's about the ecosystem service valuations of Mediterranean coastal dunes in Italy. Awesome paper. That interview will be out in probably another week or so. So stay tuned for that.
Perfect. And then we'll have, so that's one of our special episodes. We also have one that I mentioned last week with a woman who went and did a whirlwind year-long tour of marine protected areas around the world. So we interviewed her, and that recording will be out soon as well. So you've got lots to look forward to, but we hope to see you back for our regular Octopod every Friday as well. And thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Bye.
To dive deeper into the content we talked about this week, check out the episode notes or go to octogroup.org, where you can find a link for this podcast. Thank you all for listening in. Please rate us on iTunes or wherever you are listening and give us a shout with any feedback you have. We would love to hear from you.